Hi people, welcome to the podcast. And today's podcast is Finding the Song in the Stones, which is going to be about how I wrote the Boudicca books, not what they're about, but how they came about. So to understand that, we have to go back to when I was roughly 9 years old, I think, and my father took my brother and I to the Brochs at Duckleton Buoy. And Brochs are a completely Scottish phenomenon. If you've never seen one, then you should. Although I think the ones at Duckleton Buoy are on private land now. I think you're not allowed to just park the car and go in and wander around in the way that we did. Stonehenge is much the same. In those days, we parked the car and wandered around the stones. The Brochs are not as big as Stonehenge, but in many ways they're more intricate. They're kind of beehive-shaped, big dwellings, about 6-7 metres high, maybe 20 metres external diameter, and they've got double-skinned walls that are probably about 3-3.5 metres at the base apart, so you could fit cattle or people in the space. And as I remember, they were 7 stories high, but the walls kind of narrowed as they got towards the top, so you could fit, I don't know, sacks of grain or something in the second series, and then tools maybe in the third, and by the time you get up to the 4th, 5th, 6th, you were probably had mice and not much else. And nobody seemed to know what they were for. And as far as I can tell, still nobody knows what they're for. But that really wasn't the point. The point back then, I was 9, I was beginning to explore the world. It was a kind of a misty, must have been a summer's afternoon, middle of the summer holidays. Dad and my brother were off somewhere else, and I was in the middle of this broch, and I could hear the Song of the Stones. And speaking from the perspective of an adult, many decades later, it still puts the hairs up on the back of my neck. I could feel the ancestors. I could taste the past. It was a completely unique experience. I've never had it before. I've never really had it since. And I didn't have any clue at all what it was that was happening, except that I needed to know more about it. And standing out, I remember we walked out onto the hillside, and I think you can see the sea from there, or I thought I could see the sea from there. And I remember thinking that what I needed to do with the rest of my life was find out what had just happened. And of course I didn't. I went back home and I read stuff, I'm sure. That must have been around the time I was reading Rosemary Sutcliffe's Eagle of the Ninth, which tells us somebody who goes north into the mists of Scotland and what they find there. And I read The Hollow Hills and The Crystal Cave, and I learned about what seemed to me to be magic and the gods that were the old gods that felt to be the real gods to me. But I didn't really follow it through. I went off to be a vet, which is probably the polar opposite of that. It was as scientific as I could make myself be. I did do some druidic work when I was a student. We went over to Edinburgh and we explored caves near Roslyn that had, I think, old, old prehistoric paintings of kestrels in them or something like that. I was trying, but by final year I abandoned all of that and I was just a pure scientist. And then I came down to Cambridge, and I was a house officer at the Cambridge Vet School, and then I went on to be an anaesthetist, and moved around between Cambridge and Newmarket, doing horses mostly, because that was my thing. And I got to the point where I realised that I really didn't want to be a vet, or only a vet, for the rest of my life. I might have been working a 12 to 14 hour day in a 7 day week, but there had to be something beyond this. And I didn't have time to study or do anything else. So I started writing novels, because of course anyone can write a novel, and it's easy, and you just sit down and stare at a blank page until your forehead bleeds, for which we credit Douglas Adams. And in the end you have a novel, and it's shortlisted for a major literary prize, because that happens to everybody, and all of your work colleagues think that you are in fact completely crazy, which is what happened. I wrote Hen's Teeth. It was shortlisted for the Orange Prize. I think I wandered in and told everybody, and it garnered about 2 seconds interest, and we carried on with doing the orthopaedic list for the day. But it was a start, and quite soon after that I realised that I didn't have to be working full time, and I could work part time, and I could earn a little tiny bit of money from the novels, and life was okay. It wasn't the end of the world that I wasn't being an anaesthetist all day every day. And I got to the end of the first series, and I'd begun to go to crime festivals and talk to other crime writers, because of course the early books were crime thrillers. It's what I was reading and it's what I could do without doing any research. I didn't have time to go and sit in the library. I did have time to go into the pathology lab and talk to some super bright pathologists and find out all the ways that they had already worked out that one individual could kill another in a way that their fellow pathologists would have a really hard time finding out. So that was my research. I didn't sit down and read any books at all for the first three novels. And by the fourth, I was working at the vet school in Dublin, and I was living in and amongst Irish culture, so the fourth has quite an Irish flavour to it. But I still didn't actually do any research. And then there came a day when I was walking along Newmarket Heath with my lurcher, like you do, and she put up a hare, like she did. And hares are sacred to the old gods, but when it was Inca versus a hare, usually the hare won. And if it didn't, then I thought it had been a pretty even match. But she caught this one and she brought it back to me, and it was a lactating doe, which was pretty much of a catastrophe, because that meant that there were kits out somewhere on the heath and that they were going to die if I didn't find them. So I spent the entire day looking, and not surprisingly I didn't find them, because that's the point of being a hare kit. You lie on your form and you don't move. And it seemed to me that if something, several things that were sacred, had to die to get me to realise that I was walking along with my brain in neutral, then it really mattered that I not walk along with my brain in neutral. And what I had been doing was thinking about the next book, which was going to be a thriller. So I took myself off into Thetford Forest, and there was at that time a very, very big, very old hazel tree. Huge. You could have put six people around it with their arms outstretched and their fingers would not have touched. And it's gone now because people cut down the old sacred trees. But in those days I was able to sit under it and do a vision quest. And we can talk about vision quests some other time. No food, no water. Sit with the question until you have the answer. Don't do this at home, people. It depends on knowing how to set a question, what to ask, how to ask, who to ask, how to hear the answer in a way that you know is not your own projection. So I sat. And the answer that came was that I needed to write the Buddhika books. Which is fine, because I had made a commitment to write the Buddhika books in shamanic ceremony about, I know, 6 or 7 years before. But it was always going to be when I had done enough of a writing apprenticeship to be good enough to take on such a huge potential subject. And that was always going to be 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 books away. I wasn't ready to do it now. I wasn't a historian or an archaeologist or an anthropologist. I was a vet. And so I argued, which is what I teach my students not to do. Don't argue with the gods and the guides and the ancestors. You're very respectful. And you say yes. And you listen. And you do what they ask of you. And so I bargained. And I made a bargain that I would go home and do the research. And if I had enough by the time the money ran out, then I would try and write the book. If I didn't have enough by the time the money ran out, then obviously I was going to have to go back to work full time. So I came home, eventually, and I started doing the research. And I was near Cambridge, and I had access to all of the Cambridge libraries, to the classics library, to the archaeology library, to the anthropology library, to the people who ran those libraries, to the people who stocked those libraries. I had access to the early internet, to, I don't know, pre-Google probably, certainly no Facebook, no Twitter. There was a thing called BritArch, which was the British Archaeology mailing list. And I would get on it, and there would be, okay guys, so I found this amazing book in the classics library full of harness mounts, bronze harness mounts made by the Iceni, and they're absolutely beautiful and amazing. And what do you do with them? Because I'm writing this novel and I need to know how you use them. And the answer would come back from the masterminds of BritArch. You mount them on harness, little girl. And I think, okay, I have 2 postgraduate degrees and actually I could work that out. But if I'm going to write a novel, I need to know how you use them. I need to know what you do with them. I need to know how they fit. I need to know what they're for. I need to know why I, a late pre-Roman Iron Age bronzesmith, might actually put the hours and the hours and the hours into making one of these things. And in the echoing silence came a man from Norfolk who made his own harness and drove his own horses. So I got to go up to Norfolk, which wasn't far from where I was living then, and I got to drive a horse, which was a lot harder than I thought it was. I think we ploughed a bit of field. And then we took apart his harness, and we looked at the harness mounts, and we worked out, because a horse may have grown bigger, but it hasn't essentially changed in shape and what we do with it hasn't essentially changed. And we worked out where the harness mounts must have gone. And then that lot got edited out of the first of the Buddha kippos because there really wasn't room for everything that I wanted to put in. So one day, when I do the author's cut, that will go back in again. But that kind of research was a whole new thing for me, to be able to go out and actually do research. I went and learned how to make an Iron Age sword. I lived in a roundhouse for a week, which completely transformed my concept of living, of living as a human being, of living in a place where the fire provides your heat and your light and your warmth and your cooking, and what it is to walk through woodland and be completely obsessed about finding the dry wood on the ground. Any bit of dry wood suddenly becomes a trophy to take home. And I understood why they coppiced the things that they coppiced, how they managed their wood, how they built things out of stone, because this was the time when the brochs were being built. The first centuries of the last century BC and the first century AD, or what we now call BCE and CE, because we don't have to nail things to a person who didn't exist. So all of that began to feed into the Buddhika books. But then the thing that really made them what they were was listening to the songs of the stones, hearing the songs of the stone, actually hearing the song in the fire, because by then I had learned that I could hear fire better than I could hear stones. So I got rid of the television, I got rid of the sound system. I don't listen to canned music anyway, but I was getting a little tired of my very good friends who would turn up with a CD in their hand going, "You have to listen to this, you're going to love it." And no, actually, I swear to you, I really won't. But if I can say, "Actually, I don't have any means to play that, I'm really sorry, you can take it away. It was easier then, trust me, I really won't love the music that you think I'm going to love." So no music, no television. My friends who knew not to walk up to the door unless I had told them it was okay. And I lit the fire every evening that I was at home for 6 years. And I sat with the fire and I wrote pretty much what the fire gave me to write. And it wasn't easy, and it wasn't by any means the books writing themselves. And I had an incredibly good editor at that point who really got the dreaming and who didn't edit out the bits that really mattered. And we set ourselves a goal, a rule, me and the fire, which was every part of the dreaming, in the first book at least, I had either done or seen done. It had to be first hand, and obviously I don't live in first century Britain and I'm not facing the Roman invasion and the world is a different place, but even so, the dreaming is the dreaming. It has to be real. I had to relax that by the second book because there were things that the plot needed that I had heard about but never actually seen or done. But the first book, this is who we were, this is who we could be. I was able to go around the country and give talks to people and go, "This is the dreaming. The old gods are still there. This is the way that we contact them. These are the ways that we speak to them and they speak to us. And we find out what they want of us because it isn't what we're doing now." And in the process of that, I started teaching, which absolutely was not anything that I had thought I would ever do. I had been teaching when I was a vet. I taught clinical anaesthesia and I loved it. But I hadn't ever, ever expected to be teaching the dreaming. I have no doubt that my teachers of shamanic dreaming did not expect me to be teaching the dreaming. And some of them, I learned an awful lot about what to do, and some of them, I learned an awful lot about how not to teach. So I brought all that together, and I've been teaching now for 11 years. I have some people who have been learning with me from 11 years. And my life has changed out of all recognition. My understanding of the dreaming has changed out of all recognition. There is, I am told, a poster on the wall at the Esalen Institute in California saying, "We teach best what we most need to learn." And definitely, as far as I'm concerned with the dreaming, that's absolutely true. If I hadn't been teaching, I wouldn't have learned what I needed to learn. So I am endlessly grateful to the students who came and to the ones who showed me the power of what it can do to change lives. Because in the end, why are we writing if not to transform people's lives? We want to entertain, definitely, but we want also... I'm sorry, there's a cat walking over my desk. We want also to transform people's lives. And I've got the students who testify to that, and I've got emails from all around the world, from people whose lives have been opened up to the possibility that the world is not only as we see it. So this is where we get to. We started with me at 9 years old, hearing the song in the stones for the first time and having no clue at all what was happening. And we get to the Boudicca series a number of decades later, with me hearing the song in the stones and having some clue what's happening, and hearing the song in the fire and the stars and the rains and the rivers and the oceans and the winds, and listening to the gods and the ancestors and the guides, and asking what do you want of me, and the answer having been to write those books and then to move on and see what else we can do to change the trajectory of where we're going. Because it seems to me we are actually at the end of history. We are driving the vehicle of climate change off the edge of the cliff with our foot ever faster on the gas, and we don't really know what to do about it. And I don't know what to do about it any more than anybody else, but I know that it's happening. We're in the middle of the sixth great extinction, the biggest since the dinosaurs were lost 65 million years ago, and we're still using depleted uranium weapons that have a half-life of many millions of years that will be around long after we have made ourselves extinct. And we don't know what to do, and we don't know how to change it, and we're so afraid of the possibilities that we're not even discussing it. So here I am beginning to discuss it, because I don't think the song in the stones is telling us to stay locked in denial. And if the books open anything up, they open up our ability to say, really, we're completely stuck. We've got no idea what we need to do, only that we need to do something. And somewhere in all of this, there has to be an answer. And if anybody comes any closer to an answer as a result of having read the books, or if I do as a result of having written them, then it has to be worth it. So that's today's podcast. Change is possible. We just need to find out how.